Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, the House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol is likely to hold its first public hearings next week. Democratic Congressman Eric Swalwell, representing California's 15th district, was in the House that day. He has quite a few thoughts on why it all happened. He was a manager for Donald Trump's second impeachment trial and someone with a front row seat at his first. The congressman says he will never forget what happened during those trials, and he doesn't think we should either. His book detailing those events is titled Endgame, Inside the Impeachments of Donald J. Trump. Congressman Eric Swalwell joins me to talk about what he witnessed and why he believes our democracy is, at this moment, especially fragile. Congressman, the House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection is likely to begin its first public hearings next week. What are the questions you hope the committee will address?
Well, good morning, Diane. And I really do hope that the committee addresses how was Donald Trump able to organize, assemble, and aim a mob at the Capitol? What did he know in the days leading up to January 6th about who was going to show up and what their intentions were? What did he know on that day? As the mob was assembling and preparing to move to the Capitol, why didn't he send more troops to the Capitol to defend the Capitol and assist the Capitol police? And of course, I think there are a lot of questions about what can we do to make sure that this never happens again. And as Republicans work to erase that day and rewrite that day as something that was to celebrate, you know, what can we do to hold up the police officers and the custodial staff that defended the Capitol to make sure that they are always honored and that, you know, we remember the service that they gave, the sacrifices they made, and why, again, we can't let this happen again.
What do you make of the fact that so many Republicans are saying it was just an ordinary day, an ordinary visiting day?
They're scared, Diane. They're scared of Donald Trump. He's gone to many Republican districts to support challengers to Republicans who have held him accountable for what he did on January 6th. And, you know, no event in American history has been more recorded than January 6th. So as I prepared this for Donald Trump's impeachment as a impeachment manager, we saw, you know, hours of different angles of this attack, whether it was Donald Trump's speech and his words, or the $50 million that he spent in the days leading up to this attack to aim the mob at the Capitol. And then, of course, the on-the-scene footage from so many people who came because, in their words, as they told the FBI and they would tell courts as they were being held to account, Donald Trump invited them. Donald Trump told them to come. So it's indisputable that this day happened, that Donald Trump was the main motivator. And it's just my hope that we do all we can to preserve that for the sake of history, but for the sake also of learning so that no one ever again can do this.
In an update to your book, Endgame, you describe your personal experience on that day. Can you tell us about where you were and what you experienced?
I wrote a book about impeachment a year before the insurrection. It was called Endgame, Inside the Impeachment of Donald Trump. So we added four chapters, and sadly for the country, we added an S to the title, you know, Inside the Impeachments of Donald Trump. But that day, I was on the floor as a member of leadership. Speaker Pelosi really had limited who could be on the House floor because of COVID restrictions. Now, if you look at the floor that day, you'll see that there were only about 25 or so Democrats. That was the cap that she had put for who could be on the floor. It was House Democratic leadership. And of course, any state that was being challenged, like at the time your state was being challenged, you could be on the floor. So the Arizona delegation, alphabetically, they were challenged first. Now, the Republicans, they didn't follow these COVID restrictions at all. In fact, they kind of laughed at them, mocked them. And on their side, you saw the whole floor was full. So there weren't many Democrats on the floor. Instead, we were mostly in the gallery. So any colleague that was not in leadership, they were one level above in the House gallery. And so I was on the floor as I started to see the reports, you know, that the mob was moving toward the Capitol.
How did you get those reports?
My phone. So I was sitting next to a couple colleagues, and we were looking at our phones in disbelief because we were there to listen to the debate between both sides. And we saw images on our phone of the mob moving closer and closer to the Capitol. And we were also getting Capitol Police alerts that the first one that was quite stirring was that pipe bombs were found, you know, near the Capitol. And, you know, that got a lot of our attention because we worried that if the mob was also coming to the Capitol, that anyone who was trying to breach the Capitol may also be using pipe bombs. And as I sent a text message to my wife, one of them mentioned and referenced the bombs, that we didn't know what the intent was, but that the Capitol Police had already found pipe bombs. And Diane, as you know, today, we still have not found the person who placed the pipe bombs near the Capitol. But I went to Ruben Gallego, who is an Iraq war veteran, a close friend of mine, and I told him we should stick together. His wife had been text messaging me and asking me to make sure I watch him. She knew that Ruben, as an Iraq war veteran, may not listen to the orders, you know, of the police and may, you know, try and engage with the mob. So we agreed that we would leave together. And I remember Ruben taking off his coat, telling me I should take off my coat, and also grabbing a pen and saying, get one of these for yourself and go for the throat if anyone gets near you. And so it got pretty serious pretty quickly. And pretty soon you heard the banging on the doors. But you couldn't see anything because there weren't many windows. And you heard yelling and shouting from the mob. And then pretty soon you also heard the smashing of the glass on the windows, the very small windows that were on the front doors and the speaker's gallery. We were told to take out our gas masks. So I didn't know this, but underneath every chair in the House of Representatives is a gas mask. And so I pulled out my gas mask and I looked at it because it's in a sealed package. And I looked at Ruben and I said, Ruben, you know, what the hell do I do with this? Like, I've never had to take out a gas mask before, but because Ruben has served in a theater of war, he knew. And pretty soon you saw the veterans in our caucus helping many members take out, unseal, and put on their gas masks because they had experience doing it. And so next thing you know, you have dozens of gas masks in the gallery and on the floor. And we were awaiting instructions as to where to go. And fortunately, we were able to leave and take an evacuation route off the floor. And that's, of course, as the country knows, that's when Ms. Babbitt breached the speaker's gallery doors you know, was killed by the police officer who was protecting those doors. That is when I was exiting and moving out and away from the floor.
So I gather no one really panicked. It was instruction and reaction to those instructions.
It was very, very tense, and there was a lot of anxiety in the room. And I really have to credit Speaker Pelosi's floor staff, who was instrumental in keeping everybody calm. They were essentially relaying what they were hearing. There was a couple security officers from the Capitol Police who would update us from time to time. And only once, Diane, and I mentioned this in the book, from the gallery, a Democrat did panic and started shouting and screaming at the Republicans, this is your fault, this is your fault, tell Donald Trump to call this off. And what was amazing about that moment was almost to a T, every Republican and Democrat on the floor looked at that individual and said, stop. Like, this is not the time to litigate this. You know, just stop. Because we were afraid that, you know, you would have this, you know, stampede or this almost riot break out on the floor. And we thought, like, we had to listen to the police. That was not the time to fight each other because it was so uncertain as to what was going to happen next.
But did you know in your heart that it was Donald Trump? Did you believe that at that moment?
You know, I had seen the footage, and I remember holding my cell phone and handing it to my colleagues as he was speaking, where he said he's going to go to the Capitol and that people have to fight like hell. And we'd also reviewed the Mo Brooks footage where he said, you know, it's time to take names and kick some behinds, as he put it in different language. And so we always, though, thought, Diane, that the Capitol was fortified. We never believed that as angry and fired up as the mob was, that they would be able to breach the Capitol. And so we watched, you know, just with horror as they went past each barricade and perimeter that the Capitol Police had set up. And, you know, I do remember thinking at some point when you heard the banging and the shouting and the smashing of glass, like, this can't be happening. That was like the constant thought I had, was like, it can't end this way. Like, there's no way. And I remember like getting emotional and tears starting to like come down. Like it can't, like, our country cannot end this way, was like the feeling that I had. And honestly, Diane, it was the same feeling I had in 2016 as I saw the results coming in on election night. I remember, as you know, Florida was called for Donald Trump, and then pretty soon, you know, Michigan and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin were called for Donald Trump. It was just a disbelief that, like, how did this person who pandered to grievances and riled up so many people, and I really thought brought out the worst in us, how was he able to win? It was very much the same emotion I had on the floor, which was like, how has our great country succumbed to this? With, as I said, the uncertainty about what was going to happen next for my personal safety and, of course, for the country.
I think the country felt the same way watching what was happening. How can this be happening in our country? How can this capital of ours be breached this way? It was unbelievable to think that there was not adequate protection for that place that is so precious to our country. Did you at that time wonder where the protection was, where the National Guard was, where somebody was?
Yeah. So we had, as I said, a security officer who kept updating us. And there was a Capitol Police officer who was in what I would call like riot gear, who kept coming up to the podium and telling us what was going on. And that my constant thought was, well, surely there are more of you than there are of them, or surely they're not going to get past, you know, the, as I said, the perimeter that you should have set up. Because as we know, during the summer, there were Black Lives Matter protests, and there was just a phalanx of officers that protected the Capitol during the summer. And the moment that I realized we were outnumbered was when the House chaplain, unannounced and unsolicited, went up to the front podium, the same podium that the President of the United States speaks from, you know, during the State of the Union. And the House chaplain just randomly started reading a prayer. And that's when the House chaplain, I had gaveled in the session that day. Speaker Pelosi had asked me right before the debate had started to gavel in the session, to have the chaplain lead us in prayer. And that was her first day on the job as the new House chaplain. And I knew she had a military background. So when she led us later in this unannounced prayer, it felt to me in many ways like a last rites. Like, she saw that there was this uncertainty. And so she was now, you know, calling on us, you know, to all be in peace. And that's when I realized we weren't going to be protected by the Capitol Police, that they were outnumbered.
But Congressman Saltwell, how do you explain the mindsets of the many Republicans who, right after that attack, voted against certifying the election?
As we were leaving the floor, you could only move as fast as the slowest person in front of you. So there were times where, you know, I can still hear the Capitol Police officers yelling at us to move faster, but you couldn't move at all because there was kind of a bottleneck. And there were times during like the bottlenecking in the stairways and the tunnels and the hallways where I would bump into a Republican who had been at the rally or a Republican who had helped Donald Trump tell the big lie. And I believed naively that, well, maybe this is sadly is what it is going to take, that we're both running for our lives from this mob. And maybe this is what it's going to take to be the antidote, you know, to what's going on outside, that, you know, unity would help us get through this. And you're right. Within hours, no lesson was learned. We spent hours once we went back to the floor debating the big lie. We went all the way until about 4 a.m. Because Arizona and Pennsylvania, you know, and, you know, other states were challenged. And we didn't have that September 11 like unity moment where when I was an intern back in 2001, I remember Republicans and Democrats standing on the steps of the Capitol arm in arm, singing God Bless America, and then going to work very much in a unified way through the September 11 independent bipartisan commission to make sure that a day like that would never happen again. And we never had that moment. Again, you would soon see in the days after that there was one version of that day that was being told. You know, the big lie would be replaced by, you know, the big lie about what happened that day. And there was another version of these police officers like Officer Michael Fanone and Harry Dunn, who were desperate for the world to know what they sacrificed and what they experienced.
Tell me your reaction to Mitch McConnell's statement that very day, talking about Donald Trump.
Well, it was cold comfort because as impeachment managers, we really believed that he was the linchpin. As I presented the case on the Senate floor, he was only footsteps away from me. He and Chuck Schumer were the closest persons seated to every manager. And I saw in every second that I spoke and every piece of footage that I showed that Mitch McConnell was tracking the arguments that I was making and the arguments my colleagues were making. And the staff who were a part of the first impeachment, you know, the Ukraine incident, they said this was a completely different trial and that Mitch McConnell and Republicans were completely checked out. They didn't track, they didn't follow, they didn't care. Here, as I laid out, I was responsible for the chapter that was called The Attack. And so I presented about an hour's worth of footage of the mob descending into the Capitol, the Senate being evacuated and the House being evacuated. I showed the senators footage they'd never seen before, including them running for their lives through the first floor of the Capitol, Senator Schumer running for his life as he walked up an exit route and then encountered the mob and turned around and ran down the route. That was my chapter. And I saw Mitch McConnell at times tearing up because it was footage that was so hard to watch. And so it was cold comfort because it felt like he did not have the courage, the imagination, or the, you know, creativity to think beyond just keeping his job, that it was, you know, he couldn't vote guilty because he would lose his job, but he would make this 20-minute speech saying that Donald Trump was entirely responsible and should be held accountable civilly, but he was giving him this loophole because he was no longer president and didn't believe a former president could be impeached.
A quick break. The rest of my conversation with Congressman Eric Swalwell when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Democratic Congressman Eric Swalwell of California. He is author of Endgame, Inside the Impeachments of Donald J. Trump. You know, in your book, you write that Donald Trump was skilled at getting people, some people, to, quote, overthink how to deal with him. What do you mean by that? And give us some examples.
Yeah, during the 2016 election, an example I think of is that Donald Trump said over and over and over again that the election was going to be rigged, that, you know, it would be stolen, just as he did in 2020, but that the election was going to be stolen. There were going to be millions of illegal votes. And that was how he helped explain, even after winning the Electoral College, the, you know, difference between the popular vote and the Electoral College. He had kind of laid up that argument. And as we investigated what the Russians had done in 2016, it was very clear that the Obama administration was hesitant to attribute Russia's disinformation campaign and its efforts to help Donald Trump, because Donald Trump was saying during the campaign the election was going to be rigged. So it was in their head that Donald Trump had seeded this, and they were afraid that if they were too forward-leaning about what Russia was doing, that you would almost validate what Donald Trump was saying in a different way, that Russia was interfering and the election may be rigged. Bob Mueller, I think, made the same mistake. And as he testified to the House Intelligence and Judiciary Committees about his report, he was asked, well, why didn't you subpoena Donald Trump? You know, why didn't you essentially cross the red lines that he had set about going into his finances or asking him about what he knew? And Mueller said that it would have taken too long. And as anyone who's been involved in a white-collar investigation knows, that these investigations take years, and Mueller had moved at a record clip. However, Donald Trump had said for months that this was a witch hunt, it was taking too long. And so Donald Trump had set this artificial deadline for when the investigation had to end, and Mueller was following it. And so Donald Trump was masterful, I think, at getting very smart, reasonable persons with integrity to kind of follow, you know, his artificial deadlines, or to take on the straw men that he would create. And it always would end up benefiting him and hurting the country.
How much did Ukraine change that?
You know, Ernest Hemingway wrote in The Sun Also Rises, two characters were discussing how one character had gone bankrupt. And the character asked the other, well, how did you lose all your money? And he said, two ways, gradually and suddenly. And that's how I felt about the first impeachment, which was, how was Donald Trump impeached? Well, two ways, gradually and suddenly. Like, there was a buildup to it from what we learned in the Mueller report, from what he was doing, almost daring us to impeach him with his engagements with Russia and Vladimir Putin. And then suddenly, when the day after Mueller testified to Congress, July 25, he makes this call to President Zelensky in Ukraine, and recognizing that Joe Biden is probably going to be his political opponent, you know, asks Zelensky to put dirt on Joe Biden. So once we had that evidence, we thought there was no other alternative. And when you saw the national security Dems, as I called them in the book, the seven members of the freshman class who had a national security background in the military and intelligence come out and say that, you know, that was their own red line, that was the impetus for us doing that.
Now, you have filed a lawsuit against Donald Trump, Giuliani, Donald Trump Jr., and Republican Congressman Mo Brooks of Alabama for their role in inciting January 6th. Where does that stand?
I filed that lawsuit because of accountability and wanting to make sure that everyone who was principally responsible for January 6th was held accountable. In a civil lawsuit like that, one of the most difficult hurdles is what's called the motion to dismiss. And it's the first motion that has to be decided, essentially, in the proceeding. And so Donald Trump and Mo Brooks are asserting that because they were holding a public office, they're immune from such lawsuits. They're immune from being sued for disrupting, you know, the public act of counting the votes, that they're immune from, you know, intentionally inflicting emotional distress on myself and the others who were there that day. And so if we survive that motion to dismiss, which I do believe the courts are going to find that there are acts that are well outside your official duties, like when you have a political rally outside of your public office and you fire up the crowd and you spend 20 days and $50 million in ads to have that crowd come and then you aim them at the Capitol, that that is indeed outside of the liability protection that you have. Then we would move on to what's called the discovery period. So there would be depositions and evidence that we could ask of those plaintiffs. And then the court would rule on what's called a summary judgment. So looking at the facts most favorable to me, the plaintiff, should this case go to a jury, typically that motion goes in favor of the plaintiff once you've gotten past the motion to dismiss, and then it's in the hands of a jury. So if we survive the motion to dismiss, I do believe this would, you know, hurdle toward a jury trial in the District of Columbia. And I do hope that, you know, we have our day in court where we can, you know, have that one truth, the one version of the truth and the facts come out.
With Attorney Floyd Abrams on your side, how soon do you think that particular issue is going to be decided?
You know, we're so blessed with a number of talented lawyers, and Floyd Abrams filed an amicus brief for us this week. And, you know, we also have Norm Eisen from the Brookings Institute. We have Professor Larry Tribe helping us, and the chief lawyer is Phil Andonian. So I do think, you know, they're with us, and we're seeing other amicus briefs being filed in the coming days from a number of talented legal minds, just wanting to draw a line between what is an official act and what is well outside, and wanting to recognize that if we say that a president can aim a mob, a violent mob at the Capitol, then there's almost nothing that is outside of that immunity that presidents are afforded. And so really wanting to make sure that, you know, we establish some boundaries.
And which court will hear this?
It's the U.S. District Court for Washington, D.C. It's Judge Mehta, who's the judge. And, you know, ideally it would be resolved there. But of course, any appeals would go up through the Circuit Court of Appeals in Washington and possibly to the Supreme Court. So, you know, Diane, I don't have the same pressures of time that the Senate had, you know, that we had as impeachment managers, where Joe Biden was trying to put a cabinet in place. You know, we were trying to pass the America Rescue Plan to address COVID relief, and any, you know, effort to take longer than a couple days at the Senate trial was going to be met with a lot of pressure because of other responsibilities. Thankfully, collaterally, because this is a civil lawsuit, I just don't have those pressures. And so I do hope we are able to yield more evidence than we were able to get in the Senate trial.
What do you make of the cases brought by the state of New York and Cy Vance?
You know, I was a prosecutor for 7 years, and it's my hope that any case that is brought is only brought because they have the goods. They have the evidence that the facts and the law align, and that Donald Trump is treated no better or no worse than any other, you know, criminal defendant in our country. My fear is that he would be treated better because he's a former president, and that there may be this mindset that, well, we have to sweep this under the rug and let's just move on for the sake of moving on. And I really do hope that if there is evidence that as president or as a candidate, he committed a crime, that we hold him to account. I don't think this is like Gerald Ford pardoning Richard Nixon. I think that the crimes against the Constitution in the country were too great. And if, again, you can prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, that you have to pursue it for the sake of, you know, just the reconciliation that we need as a country.
Another issue you faced, you found out that Trump's Justice Department was secretly demanding that Apple turn over your data and that of your family, a move you say, demonstrates what a fragile time this is for our democracy.
I was, you know, a little bit alarmed, but frankly not surprised when I received an email from Apple a couple months ago that my data had been turned over to the Department of Justice. And actually, it was a staff member on the Intelligence Committee whose family member had their data also turned over, in addition, of course, to Adam Schiff. And we'll wait. The Attorney General called me and told me he had no idea about this, the new Attorney General, Merrick Garland, and that he wanted to have an Inspector General look into it. And I know the Judiciary Committee will look into it. But to me, as somebody who was a vocal critic, who was on the front lines on the Intelligence and Judiciary Committee, when you see that only two members of Congress were targeted, and they were the two that were the most vocal, myself and Mr. Schiff, I think the, you know, rebuttable presumption has to be that it was politically motivated. Again, I'm open-minded enough that they could have a good reason, but knowing myself that I never leaked any classified information, my presumption, knowing that Donald Trump used the Department of Justice in other instances to reward his friends and to punish his enemies, that it is something that we have to look into.
But are you afraid that this kind of behavior that Donald Trump engaged in could become the new normal?
I'm especially afraid that as we see Georgia and Texas and Florida legislatures and governors try and they learned the wrong lesson from 2020. Instead of holding up the election results, especially in Georgia and Arizona, and saying this election was one of integrity, they're trying to make it harder for a Democrat to win in 2022 or 2024. I'm equally afraid that governors or mayors would look at what Donald Trump did with the Department of Justice and think, well, I can use my own local police, my own state police, to go after my enemies. Because I do believe presidents set the tone for the country. And if you see a president using the Department of Justice, you know, for his or her personal benefit and political benefits, that it could trickle down and affect what leaders do at the state and local level. And so that's why I really do think we have to universally and in a bipartisan way condemn what Donald Trump did to make sure that this is not the new normal in America.
But considering the divisions that we all see happening on Capitol Hill and in the country right now, how can you possibly be optimistic that there will be not only a reckoning, but a beginning of understanding that Republicans and Democrats have to work together or this country is going nowhere?
You know, I find my faith in people like Ambassador Yovanovitch and Alexander Vindman and Fiona Hill, you know, all immigrants, all worked for and were appointees of a Republican president who had the courage to stand up and do what was right. I find the courage, you know, post-insurrection in people like Officer Mike Fanone, who defended the Capitol but had voted for Donald Trump, people like Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, who were Republicans but voted to impeach and have voted to hold Donald Trump accountable. And so, you know, if they can do that with great risk to themselves personally and great risks, you know, to their livelihood and their careers, then we all, with very little risk, you know, can come together as a country and, as I said, use unity as the antidote. So if they can do it, we're not asking every American to put on the body armor that Mike Fanone put on that morning to defend the Capitol as he suffered a heart attack and traumatic brain injury. We're just asking them, you know, to be a little bit more open-minded, to recognize there's only one version of the truth about that day, and for us to unite as a country. So that's where I get my faith, is, you know, what Republicans or people who supported Republicans did that day and the courage they have shown to break away from that, not for the sake of themselves, but for the sake of the country.
Finally, tell me what you believe President Biden is doing right and what his administration needs to focus on now.
He has certainly, I believe, unified the country, not in Congress, but the policies he has enacted really track with where the majority of Americans are. And I think he's right to say bipartisanship doesn't necessarily have to be bringing intractable Republicans in Congress together with Democrats, but it's bringing policies that Republicans and Democrats across the country support. And so I would give him an A, you know, in that regard. I do think that the challenge of our time right now is we see the Texas legislature on the Democratic side in exile coming to Washington because of the voting rights abuses that you're seeing there, that we have to recognize that the 2020 election did not resolve this question of Trumpism versus democracy. We thought that there would be resolution, but instead it feels very much that we're in overtime. And when you're in overtime, you have to recognize what's at stake in that, you know, it's a very fragile time. And so, you know, the COVID relief is important, but I really do think we have to put front and center, you know, these voting rights abuses and make sure that, especially in the Senate, whether it's on the For the People Act or getting the John Lewis Voting Rights Act passed, that this is seen as existential, because I do believe that there is a foreshadowing here of what's been done in Florida and Texas and Georgia and Arizona on the voting rights front, that, you know, if we don't recognize that in the Congress, that we could, just like Hungary and Hong Kong and other countries that have drifted from a democracy to an autocracy, we could go in the same direction. And so that's where I hope, you know, President Biden, you know, puts a lot of his focus in bringing the American people, you know, together around that issue.
Before we close, is there anything else you'd like to say to our listeners?
You know, in many ways, this was so predictable that we would find ourselves at this moment. And I think about the day before the Senate trial of the second impeachment, and we were in a hold room, a formal ceremonial room just off the Senate floor because of COVID restrictions. They were setting us up in that room, the Senate staff was, because only two impeachment managers could be on the floor at a time. And this IT help team had set up a copy machine, a printer. They'd given us laptops. And, you know, as one of the two millennials, I was the first to ask what the Wi-Fi password was. And they told us, well, it's under an account called Managers. And after we were given a briefing on, like, this room that we would use as a working room, I told the IT help team, I said, you know, I'm really impressed that in such short time, you put this infrastructure together for us. And without any recognition of irony and without missing a beat, this young nonpartisan staffer said to me, he said, well, sir, we were the same impeachment team from the first impeachment. And to be honest, we just left all this infrastructure up in this room because we figured you all would be back. And so to them, like, it wasn't a surprise at all. Like, they didn't even take down the Wi-Fi network that was used for the first impeachment because they figured Donald Trump would put our country in a position where he would be impeached again. And so my hope as a, you know, a legislator is that we are never in a position again where people in our country, whether it's an IT, you know, help person or a member of Congress or an everyday citizen, is so pessimistic, you know, about what a president can do to a country, that we can redeem democracy and expect better.
Congressman Swalwell, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. And Diane, it's really my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Democratic Congressman Eric Swalwell of California. He is author of Endgame, Inside the Impeachments of Donald J. Trump. And that's all for today. We'll be taking a break now for the summer. While we're away, you can enjoy a special series of interviews with some of my favorite musicians from the Diane Rehm Show archive. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, theartpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody with help from Sandra Baker. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Be well. Stay safe. I'm Diane Reed.